Welcome to the show, folks. Today I've got a treat for you. Sitting here with me in Charlotte today is Garth Moulton. Garth relocated to Charlotte from San Francisco in 2010 while he and his partners were selling a company they had started together, Jigsaw. They sold it to Salesforce.com. Garth has invested in many companies, started another one or two, and is now running sales for a very successful tech company. People, I hope to talk about all of these different topics today. Garth, thanks so much for joining me. We may have to break this into a multi-part series given how most of our conversations usually go. but thanks so much for joining us. And before we get started, I've got to know, where are you vacationing with the family next?
We leave for Cape Cod tomorrow, as a matter of fact, for just a week.
Okay.
And then we got Hawaii on tap for August.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I want to get into the trip that you took last summer or two summers ago. Yeah, that sounds awesome.
I was happy to talk about that.
So I've heard the story a bunch, but I think for people who haven't heard it, it's fascinating. First off, can you tell us about how you came to be a founder in Jigsaw and kind of what Jigsaw is and why you guys started it?
Yeah, sure. How far back you want me to start?
At the beginning.
Well, I can move pretty quickly. I grew up in Vermont. I sort of begged, borrowed, and stole my way into Brown, graduated in 1992, pretty deeply in debt, and so I just sort of did the corporate track. Mm-hmm. And it was actually a friend of mine who was an engineer who was having a hard time getting off the dime. I was like, "Well, here, I'll take you to these on-campus interview type things." And there was a technology company. This is pre-internet. Yeah, I am ancient. And there was someone from a client server technology out of Boston. And the guy they sent down to present was 24 years old. And he sort of was like, "Oh, well, 2 weeks ago I was in Hong Kong. And then I was talking to the CIO of Bank of America." And I was just
24
like,
year old.
Yeah. I was like, "Oh, I'm interested in this." So I hijacked the guy, brought him back to my fraternity. We got him all drunk. And the next thing you know, I had a second interview up in Boston. And so instead of going to work for a bank where I thought I was going to have to work, I was working for a technology company.
And it was client server technology.
Yeah. It was Unix development tools.
Okay.
And in a very hot time when a lot of these large companies were trying to get off the mainframe.
Sure.
So I didn't know anything, so they put me in sales, and I think it was I learned a lot very, very quickly, and our company was very successful, and we sold through hardware channels, and they literally put me with Hewlett Packard because I showed up tan the first day, and so that ultimately and most of the customers they were bringing through were from the West Coast, so I was the first remote employee. So I moved out to San Francisco right in the start of the tech wave.
So if you weren't tan, would they have put you on the IBM account?
I don't know. Maybe. Well, there was another guy that showed up, and he had a short sleeve dress shirt on, and they made him in charge of the Midwest. Okay. So maybe I would have been the Midwest guy, but at any rate, the 90s were my 20s in software sales, and I was just a mercenary. I just went from company to company, really just like which one of these companies is going to make me a millionaire, you know, dot-com millionaire. And I was a millionaire on paper a couple of times, but it never quite happened. And then for me, it felt like all of a sudden it was 2000 and the economy that I knew was falling. And so I chose that opportunity to take the girl I was dating, who is now my wife, and travel for a year. So in 2001, I traveled the entire year through the South Pacific and in Asia, and the economy just continued to fall. And then September 11th happened. So when I got back, the rules were a little bit different, you know. And then we very quickly got married, had a kid, and I was just like, it's not going to be okay for me just to be this sales mercenary. I'm going to have to.
Now, when you say you were a sales mercenary, were you managing sales teams, or was it at this point, was it still just going out carrying a bag?
I did both. Okay. I mean, what I was really good at was carrying a bag. I'm not a very good manager. I continue to not be great. You know, I've managed sales teams and biz dev, and in the beginning days of Jigsaw, I was all things customer facing. But you know, managing people is really not my favorite thing. So I went to work for a friend of mine who said, okay, this is like a port in the storm. And it was an email marketing company. And after a couple of months, I was like, this job's terrible. He's like, yeah, I know. He was like, but don't go. He's like, we should start a company. And he was just another sales guy. And I was just like, what do we know how to do? And he said, well, and we tried out a couple of ideas. And then I just watched him on an afternoon just spit out the idea for Jigsaw, which was it was a data company at its heart. And really, it was a collective of people's Rolodex. And this is in a time when LinkedIn and Facebook were just beginning. You know, there weren't everybody wasn't walking around with their phone with their contact manager in it.
Sure.
And there weren't all these sales enablement tools and all these databases.
Well, back then you would go buy a very expensive subscription to like a D&B or somebody else, right?
Exactly right. Your choice was Hoover's. And Hoover's, you could get the 800 number for Cisco, and John Chambers, who was the CEO at the time, and you could get his title and name, you know, and just a collection of other people who would never take your call. So the basic core business problem was that we were solving was the fact that all these on-track earning, 250K on-track earning sales guys were spending half their time just cold calling and doing we called it the admin shuffle. You know, call the 800 number, start asking questions, try not to get hung up on and
work the phone tree. Yep.
Exactly. So you really weren't spending any time selling your product. You were spending all your time just trying to figure out who you should be dealing with. So we figured who has this information, salespeople. And I was a sales guy, and I regularly would call sales guys and be like, hey, you're selling into Cisco. Who do you sell to? What's his telephone number? You know, what's his, you know, tell me. And we didn't have any money. In fact, we needed salaries. You know, we had just bought homes and we had small children. And so we got a round of funding, which now would be classified as sort of an A round, but it was $750,000. And
wow.
And we were happy to get it.
And what year was this?
2003, remember? We got funded. So we officially started on January 1st, 2004.
So building technology was a lot more expensive back then than it is
That's
now.
Right. That's yeah. right. And, you know, because it was a website. It was basically, it was a website and with a database behind it. Tom Peterson from El Dorado Ventures basically was the one VC that would take a leap of faith with us.
Okay.
That and my co-founder's stepfather and this other guy. And he candidly, Tom was like, I just want to see if you two jokers can do this. You know, and because we were two sales guys in the very much in the wake of the tech bust when venture capitalists were getting in trouble for not putting money to work because they were so gun shy. And not only did we not have an MVP, we didn't have a technology person. We had two sales guys with a PowerPoint and so we basically had about 6 months of runway and we hired the three guys. You know, there was no outsourcing and there was no apps. You know, this is again before people were carrying. Everyone was carrying a cell phone, but it wasn't a mini computer.
Sure.
And so, we were able to do it, and we were. My responsibilities while the tech guys built the site was to essentially kind of beg, borrow, and steal from every sales guy that I knew any type of their data that we could put in and that would be sort of the seed. You know, because it was a cat and mouse game, you know, or chicken and egg or whatever you want to call it. You know, you had to have enough information.
It's a network effect
so,
for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So when the people would come in, they would have enough. And we were able to pull together enough data. So right out of the chute, you know, particularly for Silicon Valley sales guys that were selling into technology companies, we had enough data. You know, we had more data and we had direct dial telephone numbers. We had email addresses and people were just... from the very start, people were salespeople were shocked. You know, it truly was disruptive.
At Amentra, we used it. I remember Mike Lambert showing me the tool, and he was our head of sales at Amentra, and this would have been 2005 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But he showed me. He's like, "It's great. You know, we can buy contacts if we want, or we can upload contacts." And
right.
I think the two things about this story that stick out the most to me, or that I'd like to ask you about, it seems like you were a little. Everybody understands that data is the new oil now, but you guys were really ahead of the curve on that, I think. I mean, I think people understood there was value in data, but mm-hmm. this is really basic data that everybody has access to. You're figuring out if I can collect enough of it in one spot, it becomes wildly,
right.
wildly valuable, but it's not valuable 10, 15 pieces of it, right?
Yeah. Well, we had, you know, more of my co-founder and CEO, Jim Fowler, he was the guy that read business books and things okay. like that. And, but you know, we both had read Net Gain and, you know, and it was sort of theoretical, you know, yeah. just like, and it's like, can't, and then, Wikipedia was just coming out and,
yeah.
and we were, you know, very interested in, could we apply user generated content to, this contact data?
Well, that's the other thing that really fascinates me. I don't recall hearing a lot about crowdsourcing back then, but I think this very much is a very early example of crowdsourcing.
It absolutely was.
Yeah.
And then a little bit later on, you know, when Web 2.0 blew up, mm-hmm. we were one of the few companies that was making money.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody was theoretical and it was so awesome in this collective of data, but we were actually making money because from the very beginning, We said, and we had to fight our VCs on this, because we had a 3-month beta period, and then we flicked the switch, and we're like, everybody pays for Jigsaw. You either put data in, mm-hmm. you help us clean the data, or you pay money, and that was our model right from the beginning. And we were very heavy on the individuals. We built Jigsaw on the backs of individuals, putting their contact information in, and then we ultimately, you know, grew and scaled and were able to sell based on the companies that would pay us money.
Was there a point where things really took off, or was it just, was it from day one people got it, or did you hit any tipping points?
I mean, I got to tell you, it's like I even remember the days, you know, we, on May 17th, 2004, we opened the website. And in the beginning, we thought it was going to be a marketing internet thing, like a tool for individual salespeople. That was sort of the world that we were thinking about, and
not loading it into a CRM system,
right?
And
right, and not
creating campaigns.
Exactly. And we realized extraordinarily quickly that companies, inside sales teams, were, you know, they were the ones that just had to have it right from the beginning.
Yep.
And we weren't even out of the beta period where they were just like, you need a corporate license. And I can remember almost from the very, very beginning, you know, it was just, I hired 3 guys off Craigslist, you know, just literally just to call people and,
wow.
and give it to them. Uh-huh. And they were just like, oh, I mean, constantly I would grab the phone and I would be like, oh, so you're all set with corporate leads. Like, you're fine. So I should talk to your manager, or I know your CEO. Should I just tell him that you guys are all set for leads? You don't need any more. And they'd be like, I'm like, sign up and use this thing. And I mean, I had countless calls. It was really fun. And anyway, right from the start, people thought we were bigger than we were.
Yeah.
I remember a very important call, and we were halfway through the beta period. It was probably July. And I got a call from the guy who was running the inside sales team for Salesforce. And he said, literally, he opened up with, he's like, okay. He's like, you got me. He was like, I got 4 guys on my team that said they're not going to come to work if we don't buy Jigsaw.
That's great.
He was like, what is it? And I was just like, well, Jigsaw is, you know, a collective of this business information. And I'm like, the reason they love it so much is, he's like, I know why they love it. He was like, okay, I want to buy it for my team. How much does it cost? And I was like, well, that's not how it works. You know, it's an individual membership. And where he was like, do you realize who you're talking to? And I was like, he was like, are you going to be able to answer my question of how much does it cost? He was like,
wow.
Because I'm not hearing expense reports and, you know, individual licenses and what. I was like, I will call you back tomorrow. And we went in and we built our corporate license, you know,
for Salesforce.
For Salesforce, and we put it in the next couple of days. And
that's great.
That became very much the revenue producer in the beginning.
Do you feel like you got pricing right? Because pricing is scary. If you set the wrong policy, it can kill you if you're growing fast.
It was so important. I mean, because it's like, you know, it's like where you put the paywall, and if you want to be more general. And as I said, we had to fight our VCs, because they were very much, they were like, no, you have to get an audience, and then you figure out how you can charge them. And from the beginning, they got very fixated on this very tiny amount of revenue that we were coming in. And we're like, we can't make large decisions based on that.
Yeah.
But it made all the difference, because if you give something away in a corporate world, it's like, that's the way they treat it. They're like, there's no value here.
I agree.
And it made our credits on our system worth money.
Yeah.
And for the first time, every sales guy thinks that his Rolodex is worth something, but there was no place to actually go and
no make market that. Clearing mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And that was the kind of the true genius in Jigsaw.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you took $750,000, I think you said. Did you guys raise a follow-on round or anything
that
you would call a Series B or C?
Yes, 6 months in, right along schedule, we were able to we did a $5.5 million that was led by a Norwest.
Oh, wow.
You know, which was not to say that El Dorado wasn't legitimate. You know, they're on Sand Hill Road, but Norwest is Wells Fargo. You know, they're extraordinarily well known now. And in fact, the Jeff Crow, the guy that was on our board, is probably one of the top 10 VCs in Silicon Valley.
That's great. Was that the last round, or did you do any follow-ons?
We did one more follow-on a couple years later, and it was in each subsequent round we quadrupled the value of the company in those first 6 months just by getting out. We were still in our beta phase, and then we quadrupled again, I think, in another 2 years. And that money we raised another $12 million, and that was almost, it was because money had become cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very much in the driver's seat, and it was more of a war chest, you know. Okay. for marketing to grow to that next level. And
did you ever do any acquisitions of other companies along the way?
Okay. It's extraordinary. It's also extraordinary the state of the actual software, you know, even when we sold to Salesforce, was just,
MacGyvered together, duct taped together,
spaghetti coated and hard coded in. And in fact, for the first something like 4 years, you couldn't just upload a file of your contacts into the, you had to, what we call, click it in.
Wow.
In other words, it would take the you know, the several lines of Excel, and they would put it into what looked like a business card, and it would show it to you, and you had to go click, yes, that's the contact.
Wow.
And people would spend hours putting it in because they wanted the credit. They wanted, it's pretty nuts. Looking back on it now, it's like, you know, and just, I mean, I work for a search engine. You know?
I think people forget, though, that back then the expectations for software were way lower than they are now.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
iPhone,
I'll tell you what, the
for
expectations
everybody.
For data, you know, there were marketing people that were buying lists that were regularly would come out to be 10% accurate,
wow,
be 15% accurate. And we, right out of the chute, we were somewhere around 60% accurate.
Jeez.
And it was like just too good to be true.
Yeah. No, that's great. I mean, it's funny because you hear a lot of talk about a 10x solution. I would argue going from 15 to 60% accuracy might be a 100x solution, really.
It really was. I mean, and it was also, in many cases, it was a zero to, you know, it's like, where can you go to get email addresses? And in the beginning, you know, the Dun & Bradstreets of the world and the LinkedIn of the world, they looked at us and they were just like, oh, you guys are sort of trafficking an email address. You're going to get shut down.
Yeah.
And because this was right, Napster blew up.
Okay.
Literally that year, 2004. And our lawyers were Wilson Sonsini. You know, one of the things we did right off the bat with our money was to go get Wilson Sonsini and ask them to break it. You know, what will take this down? And they came back with, they were like, it's business card data. Like the only thing on a business card that is sort of trademarked and is like, could be considered proprietary is the is literally is the logo on the website.
Wow.
So, and it, and actually we were originally going to, we thought that we would have to have sort of that reports to field.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually, they said that they felt that there could be an argument made within a company that that piece of information is proprietary.
Okay.
So we put it on the shelf, but we thought we were like, nobody's going to buy all this data, just raw data. You know, they're like, they're going to want reports to, you know, to put it into Salesforce.
Yeah.
And we never went there.
Wow. That's amazing. And it was game changing software. I remember that being one of the indispensable tools that we had. So it's got to be really cool to know that you built something that was so popular in the industry. Now, when did you guys start to think about selling? Were people coming to you? Did you run a process? How did that kind of come about?
Actually, what happened? Jim Fowler, my CEO, and you know, it wasn't a direct partnership. You know, it was his idea, it was his money. You know,
sure.
You know, we got started with, and he always wanted to run the company. I always say every day was Christmas for him because he was running his own company, and it was pretty. It was something to watch. I mean, we very much we existed on the plutonium that was his, his sort of general energy level, and he wanted. I mean, he wanted to change the data industry. I mean, this was never a flip it company. You know, we were not entrepreneurs like looking to put together a company and flip it.
Yeah.
And in 2008, actually, because we were partnered pretty heavily at that point with Dun & Bradstreet, and Dun & Bradstreet issued us a letter of intent. And in fact, it was kind of funny because we would put in as a proposal for how we should work together. We had an operations guy that came in and he would put it as option C, always almost as a joke. He's like, or you could buy us. And then I remember in 2008, he sort of came back to us and he was like, they want to talk about option C. And
wow.
So they, with very little input from us, they issued us a letter of intent in the summer of 2008. And we weren't ready to sell. I mean, we really felt as though we were growing very, very quickly. And we felt like...
You said winter of 08?
No, summer of 08.
Summer of 08. Okay.
So before the crisis.
Yeah.
And so we shopped the deal. You know, we hired an investment bank and... And in the meantime, they did a super amount of diligence on us as well. And then, meanwhile, like Lehman Brothers failed and et cetera. And then on November 8th, which was election day, it came back through the board of Dun & Bradstreet that they weren't going to move forward with the deal.
Okay.
And you know, I try not to associate the two events, but you know, this was crushing to me, you know, because it meant I was living in a house that I couldn't afford, you know, what I used to call my $1 million trailer in San Carlos, California, and just literally biting my nails. You're like, okay, we obviously have a tiger by the tail here.
Yeah.
Jigsaw is probably not going to close the doors and send everybody home, but I can't go totally bankrupt before, you know, so this was going to be, you know, life-changing money and everything. And also, it was I had decided that I was going to move my family to the East Coast, ultimately to Charlotte. So then, when the deal didn't go through, we decided, my wife and I decided to move to the to Charlotte.
Okay.
And so and it was so very obvious that we were entering into a downturn that we had no idea. People were talking about depression, and we didn't know. But
it was scary times. For
but
sure.
It wasn't much of a leap to think that Jigsaw is not going to sell to anybody before we come out of it. And but ultimately what that did was Salesforce became interested in us, and we popped up on their radar. And then what happened was, as they were putting at very, very high levels, as they were putting together their strategy for the kind of the data cloud, you know, they were already done the sales cloud and the marketing cloud, and now they were starting to think about the data cloud. And we very much fit into that. So 15 months later, we sold to Salesforce.
Wow, that's
but
great.
We were not soliciting at any point. You know, it's and in fact, it was there were many heated conversations and arguments with Jim Fowler, you know, because he didn't want to sell. He just felt like there was more to do, you know, and there was more. And, you know, arguably, you look back, you know, because some of our competitors at the time, you know, and it's like have since sold. And mm-hmm. and I know when LinkedIn sold for $2 billion, we were just like, you know, but it was a great event. I mean, it was life changing money, and it really very much was the capper for looking back on it. What is a very not typical, because, you know, a typical ending for a startup is failure. But, you know, just sort of a glorious, you know, just up and to the right, you know, it's, and I always laugh. I'm like, we were an 8-year overnight success.
there seem to be a lot of those that mm-hmm. look like overnight successes, but right. it's,
well, that was the environment. Part you don't see, and I would argue that the environment is still like that in Silicon Valley. It's, there's just this feeling that's like, oh my God, everybody's getting rich. Everybody's being successful. But you know what? The numbers don't play out.
Yeah.
It's everybody's failing is what's going on. And then that's like here and there, like everybody knew somebody who had, you know, made a, you know, bazillion dollars. And you get the stress.
Yeah.
We used to joke, you know, it's like, you don't want to get in between that Stanford MBA and his first startup, you know, it's like, yeah. he'll chew through you.
Oh, I love the show Silicon Valley. I think that's part of that. They nail that dynamic in the show, amongst other things that they
nail. I gotta tell you, when I first watched that, I mean, it's right in my wheelhouse from a humor point of view, but the first episode that I saw, it wasn't altogether funny to me because it was so realistic. Yeah. You know, it's like, it seems so ridiculous, but I had seen more ridiculous and more hyperbolic behavior and just idiocy.
I feel like every little detail too, like the term sheets, I think would hold up in a court of law. I think that the Java code would compile. Like it's a really, really well done show. So you mentioned moving to Charlotte. Can you talk a little bit about how you picked Charlotte, coming from really a world-class city by any stretch of the imagination in San Francisco?
Well, by that point, we had moved out of San Francisco and then we lived in San Carlos,
which is
kind of the burbs. Essentially my wife was, my wife's from Boston. I'm from Vermont. And when I met her in 2000, I said, look, a lot of my buddies, she was living in Boston. And I even said, I was like, look, a lot of my buddies here are getting married to, you know, girls from the East Coast or girls from somewhere else. And they sort of think that, you know, we're going to move back to there and, you know, have a family. I was like, I'm never leaving San Francisco. San Francisco is the center of the world. It's like, it's the greatest place ever. And I'm certainly never leaving the West Coast. And fast forward through, you know, getting married, having kids, moving out of the city, you know, and moving into what I call California, you know, which is very different from San Francisco. And then suddenly, you know, it matters when you become a taxpayer and suddenly you're paying more attention to schools and roads and basically by 2008, when we were issued the letter of intent, I had gone from saying, oh, I will never move to, okay, we should really consider it. And my son had reached school age and I was staring down, you know, two kids, 18 years of school times two, you know, times 40 grand or whatever it is. And
real estate probably isn't cheap in San Carlos. I'm guessing it's down there near Burlingame or some of those towns.
We had what we called a million-dollar trailer. What I called it. It was a 1,340 square foot ranch house on a 5,000 square foot lot.
Wow.
And I love it. People in Charlotte were just like, "How many acres is that?" I'm like, "I don't know, point something something." And I remember the first time somebody from Atlanta showed me Google Earth for the first time, he's like, look, there's your house, and I was like, my God, you know, it's just like you just become aware of like just all the reasons we wanted to kind of move out of the Bay Area were all related to population density. You know, it's just like the cost, and
traffic.
And it's like, you know, in 2000 when we were single or, you know, double income, no kids, we were going to plays and we were going to the mountains and we were going to out to dinner every night. And yeah, San Francisco is awesome. But fast forward to 2008 and we've got two babies at home and I spend 13 hours a day at Jigsaw and the rest of the time holding babies, you know, it's and everything's expensive. And if you want to go see a movie, you got to see it on Wednesday afternoon and the, you know, at a off theater, because otherwise you got to wait in line. And it was starting to wear on us. And the mantra went from, oh my God, Jigsaw has to be successful so we can stay here, to, hey, maybe we should take our winnings and go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And so I remember we got issued the letter of intent from Dun & Bradstreet. And I came home and it was 2 days after we found out that my son was number 129 for 80 spots at the local elementary school. And I said, look, I think we should consider moving. And my wife was like, okay. And I said, where do you want to go? I'm like, it needs to be a city and it needs to be the United States. And I was like, Seattle, Boulder, Austin. Austin's really cool. She was like, no, I want to live on the East Coast. And I was like, so we'll be in the same time zone as our family.
Okay.
And both of our families. I was like, okay. I was like, but I don't want to live in winter.
And I was going to say, had your blood changed and you couldn't stand Vermont winters anymore?
In every way. And she was like, oh, Lord, me neither. So I was like, okay, so this is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, we're basically talking about a Southeast city. And I'm like, we're not going to move out of a rat race, you know, high population density place into another one.
Yeah.
And so that knocked off DC, that knocked off Atlanta.
And you said you had to be, you said you had to be in America. So that knocked off Miami.
Yeah, exactly. And so we literally didn't know of any place that would fulfill those two besides Charlotte and Raleigh Durham area.
Mm-hmm.
And we had friends that had moved from San Francisco to Charlotte and loved it.
Okay.
So a couple weeks later we went and visited. You know, we drove down Queens and saw what we could get for a house, and I was like, sold, done.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's a beautiful town with lots of nice trees and flowers and everything.
Oh my word. Yeah. We moved based on that information, but I would say after 6 months of living here, both of us just fell in love with the place and the people, and I mean, our life is fantastic. I literally, not to put too fine a point on it, but we could live wherever we want.
Yeah.
And we chose here and we continue to choose here and we love it.
That's great. What you mentioned a couple of things. Is there anything else about Charlotte that you'd say has been the most refreshing to you as you reflect back after being here 10 years?
Yeah. It's, you know, from a business point of view, it was, when I got here, it was very much a fledgling technology sort of startup. You know, it was dwarfed by the banks and real estate and everything else. And it's still dwarfed by real estate, you know, and everything else. But, you know, there's been a handful of companies that have grown to unicorns, you know, just like I was saying, but I wasn't positive. And there's, you know, people like yourself, you know, that have had success here.
It's a very welcoming community, and not just the entrepreneurial community, but I've met several business people who are kind of from the old money Charlotte families, and I've never felt like they wanted to keep anybody else out from being successful. Yep. I feel like they're very welcoming to new business people, and that's why the city continues to thrive, even as industries have changed through the centuries.
Totally agree with that. From day one, we moved here on guard for sort of exclusivity from two different angles. One from the sort of Charlotte, old Southern, old money, and the other was from banking, you know, just sort of banking. And I think the fact that all the bankers got humbled in 2008, but I literally have seen none of it, you know, and just like you say, it's not just the entrepreneurial community. It's, and what I've always been struck by is just the quality of life here is so much better than in, you know, I've got friends that live in Seattle. I got friends that live in Austin.
I moved from DC. I feel like the quality, people can afford way more things here.
Yes. Yeah. And you can live your life, you know, and I do always shudder a little bit when people are just like, this reminds me of of Atlanta in the 90s. And I was like, well, okay. Well,
let's learn from those mistakes.
Yeah, exactly. Let's not outgrow the infrastructure and just bring the place to its knees. But so far, so good.
That's great. What's been the most frustrating to you of about Charlotte?
Well, I think I'll go frustration from my wife, because I honestly don't care. But it's, she definitely has withdrawal from, you know, like the great restaurants,
yeah.
You know, and it's, I like to say in Charlotte, there's one of everything that you really need, but there's not two,
no.
You know, and also a lot of restaurants that we, you know, we'll go once or twice and they'll close down. It's
yeah.
like, for whatever reason, that we can't seem to sustain like really hot, cool, nice,
yeah.
you know, expensive restaurants or whatever.
It seems to be mostly with the expensive restaurants. I think our mid-tier restaurants are actually quite good, but
yeah.
and some of the homegrown ones like Price's Chicken Coop,
sure,
you know,
sure.
there are those, but I don't think you can point to many high-end restaurants. Whereas in San Francisco, you could walk to five from, you get dropped any part of the city and you can walk to five
true.
Top-notch ones.
And yes, there's that. And also, the mid-level, even like down in San Mateo, right in the middle of Silicon Valley, where Jigsaw was, there, the choices for lunch, you know, it's like, literally, it was like, what vector do you want?
Yeah.
I mean, mid-tier Mexican, you know,
yep.
here, this price level, this quality, you know, this proximity, and there were just so many choices.
Yeah.
And but that's not much of a complaint, really. I will say that, and I do find myself saying this all the time, like, Charlotte is a fantastic place to live.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find it to be much of a destination. I mean,
yeah,
we really do struggle when people, my sister was just here with her kids and it was like, how many times can you go to Whitewater Center?
Yeah.
You know, it's, and it does, you know, I find a lot of times people will come here and then we'll go somewhere,
yeah.
you know, or we'll go, but that will come along, you
yeah.
know, that will come along.
Yeah, that I think we're seeing that, and for me, most of my frustrations have been just recently. I feel like I don't know why they can't sequence construction projects better. We're down to one lane and zero lanes uptown, and
sure.
it feels like they're working. But that's a sign of progress. I always have to remind myself that that's actually a good thing. But
that's
there's just so much construction and so much traffic lately because of that construction. But I agree. Overall, I think I'm much happier being here than in other cities where I've spent any real significant time.
Oh, with me, hands down.
Yeah.
And it's, and you know, and a lot of those places that are great to visit, like New York City and, you know, in San Francisco, mm-hmm. I mean, it's great. Go visit them.
Yep.
And then we come home. And, and I know I worked for a couple of years at a startup that was in Vienna, you know, Alphonse Corner, whatever, outskirts of DC. And I would just count my lucky stars the whole time I was up there. You
yeah.
know, I just, you know, nothing against the people or anything, but I mean,
the
traffic was horrendous.
Yeah.
And I was just like, so glad that I didn't live in that environment.
Yeah, no, that's the environment I grew up in. I was a little bit further outside of the city, although I was born further inside, and I went to school in a town right near Vienna in Fairfax. So when I first met you, you and Chris Halligan, another of my favorite local entrepreneurs and favorite people overall, you had started and were running Other Screen, and I know you mentioned when you started Jigsaw you didn't have, and you really didn't have a tech team, but the tech team that you had was awesome, to say the least.
It was homegrown too, which was we were really proud of.
Homegrown and just some real rock stars, both from a technical perspective but also just really great people. Ultimately Other Screen didn't work out. Can you tell us about the company and when you kind of realized that it might need fixing or that you might need to pivot or do something differently with it?
Sure. We, it was Other Screen. It was sort of capitalizing on the basic second screen idea, which I guess caught on. And this was 2011, because
mm-hmm.
it was actually, Chris and I got together during my 1 year earnout from Salesforce. I mean, the plan was not to immediately jump into another startup.
And he had recently sold a company to Salesforce as well, right?
Yeah. He's a company called, I think it was called Keaton.
Okay.
But, Yeah, he, you know, he was from Dell and Web Methods after that, and then he was working on PokerTech, which which he was the CEO, and he wasn't that into that. And he, but I met the guy and the idea, you know,
And he's brilliant. I mean, he's hands down brilliant.
He is. He's you know, my top mentor, and just yeah, his capacity is incredible. And so I was just like, yeah, I'm. If you want to do this and you're willing to have me, I'm in and I'm here. And it was basically the year that iPads took off.
Okay.
And people have always, and it was attacking the basic observation that you could see at the time and still, that while people are watching television, they're also on their other devices. A little bit less the case that now that most people are watching television on their devices,
yeah.
but this was, and we were just, we wanted to, and we, Other Screen was an app that was, that you interacted with while you watched a live television event. And it was not patched into the actual event. You know, the only thing that was keeping it together was the fact that it was occurring at the same time.
Yeah. And you had some sort of MC that would kind of oversee the game, and the game involved
exactly
the live sport event.
It was basically a game. It was like a proposition, you know, like what's going to happen next. We started with sports because that was the natural, and we would have an actual human that was asking sort of pre-baked questions like, you know, is Michael Vick going to score, or you know, are the Redskins going to get a first down, or you know, something that was going to be resolved in the next little while or throughout the course of the game. And then you would get points.
Yep.
We also asked trivia questions, which we were able to compile by putting it up on a Mechanical Turk, and people would just, you know, for $20 they would get these well researched, you know, 20 or 30 questions that the human, you know, could actually put out. And then and while they were doing this, they were chatting, and then they were all in theory watching the game.
Yeah.
And then that morphed into, we found that it was really good for, it was a little bit much for to watch a game and chat and play the game. And well, it was always too much for your standard human being.
Yeah.
And which is one of the reasons it didn't really take off. But we found that we were really good at
game shows, right?
Events like the Oscars.
Oh yeah,
and then
yeah.
Also the
reality TV,
The Bachelor. Reality TV, The Bachelor was actually our most popular thing, and it was grueling to be the human because there were only five of us, so we would sort of all take turns being the sort of the MC, if you will. And I only did The Bachelor once. I was like, this makes me want to vomit. I'm like, I just can't I can't do it. And I'm not saying that because I want to be cool. I'm saying that because that's the way it was.
Yeah.
But we had an audience. But the problem was, engagement. But the problem, we didn't even really get to the monetization. You know, it's because we didn't even really figure out the engagement model. But
you had a contract with one of the local Fox affiliates or something at some point.
We did,
right?
And that was already when we were starting to think of, because our original, we actually got some funding based on the business model of. We never thought we were going to sell advertising. We knew we were never going to get to that level of eyeball or that level of complexity. You know, trying to convince that industry that an engaged eyeball is more valuable than just a regular eyeball, that ship sailed. I mean, nobody.
Yeah.
Was, you know, if Google and Microsoft can't convince the industry of that, then we weren't.
Yeah.
So we thought we would. What we had was the ability to do these engaged focus groups, because essentially we could ask questions. During the ads, we would be like,
did you see this ad?
Yeah. Well, we wouldn't ask that. We would ask which beer vendor had a commercial during the commercial break, you know, and it would be like Coors, Bud Light, whatever, or there wasn't a, you know, and they would get points. And so they would watch ads, and that was
that's
intriguing.
Very cool. Yeah.
But unfortunately our numbers were, and what we would hear all the time, they were like, you know, this would be we're very interested in this. You know, we had, you know, advertising group that works for AB, you know, they're like, we are extraordinarily interested in this. You need to multiply this times 3 zeros and then it's going to be really interesting. We were like, yeah, that's no world where that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So we were already by the time we were working with the Fox affiliate, we were already starting to pivot, and we were like, okay, the rumblings were out. You know, like, if we're going to turn this into a business that makes money, we're going to have to do something pretty differently. So we thought that we would be the second screen platform for, you know, local television stations who are in serious trouble, you know, from their monetization model. And we did. We were so successful. We had a show, a live news show that was on the local, and they loved it, and everybody loved it.
Still the same MC format, or were they providing some of that kind of
no
program?
You didn't really. They were, things were popping up, and it was a human that was
okay.
was doing it, but it wasn't. We weren't interacting. You know, they were. It was all the TV show. The two hosts of the TV show, and it was very popular. Very popular. You know, we had upwards of 200 people, you know, watching at the same time, and one fallout from Other Screen was, we had an audience. We had this core audience. You know, people that would play no matter what event, they would be there. Unfortunately, it was about 25 people. But those 25 people, literally, they were so sad when we left. And you know some of them. Some of them are local people. But
absolutely. We had some Reward Summit fans that were that way when we shut it down. They were like, oh, man, I use that app every day.
Right. And you were like, well, unfortunately, we needed
We needed, 10,000 more of 10,000 times as many of you doing that. So was there a point where you knew it couldn't be fixed? Because it sounds like you started pivoting, but you still weren't really getting traction. Was there like an exact moment where you said, you know, what, this just isn't going to happen?
Yep, there was. Through a connection of ours, a local connection of ours, I got connected to the owner of a couple of affiliates up in Charleston, West Virginia. Very, very high level. And he was like, okay, I will amass my entire team. You come up, and I drove up there, and I pitched, and I know the day, you know, and I drove up there, and I pitched, and I, just for kicks, I took all the objections that I had been getting from
broke out the battle card completely.
Yeah, and I just said,
and he lied about
the
product.
Like, we can do that. Yeah. I'm like, we can do that. I'm like, and this is how you do it. And I was like, yeah, same price, you know, $1,000 a year, you know, and the two tech guys in the audience were like, I mean, sorry, they were looking at me. They were like, this guy's full of shit.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, just bear with me. And because I really was testing it. I was like, okay, I basically doled out the unicorn of everything that this could possibly be for essentially for free. And we would do everything. You know, there's no business model that there would be no scaling of this. And they still, and I was like, when are we going to start? And they were like, I was like, this is not a business.
Yeah.
And I came back and I called up Chris on the way home, on the 5-hour drive home. And I said, look, I'm like, we're in trouble here.
Yeah.
We do not have a business.
Yeah.
And we,
and sometimes you think maybe you're not selling it the right way, but you and Chris are both proven salespeople.
We are.
Yeah.
And we tried a lot of stuff. You know, it wasn't like we were, oh, we tried it the way we originally thought it was going to go. And it didn't happen, and we gave up. And that is not the way. I mean, I was cold calling, you know, radio stations, and we went to car dealerships, and I had them. I learned a ton about all sorts of different businesses, and basically got my general sort of fear about, you know, I'm worried about local TV stations. You know, just like, I don't understand how they're going to stay in business.
Oh, I agree. Now, so you went back, you talked to Chris. He's seeing kind of the same thing. Andrew, Jim, Mike, all the other really talented folks who were there and really bought in. I mean, did they take a lot of convincing, or could they see the writing on the wall?
They were
as well?
Right with us. Okay, because we did some offsites and we really sat down and thought strategically. You know, like, what are we going to do? Like, what do you think we should do? And because we weren't, because this wasn't our first rodeo. And we were, and both Chris and I were, you know, there was a lot of our own money into this. Mm-hmm. We made the decision to shut it down. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if we were first time entrepreneurs, then the VCs would have had enough power. They would be like, no, try everything, spend all the money, you know, and then send everybody home. And like is classic what happens in Silicon Valley. You know, it's they try to shoestring it together. They can never like they can never give up the ghost, and people work for free. And, you know, and it's like, you know, and it really would have hosed the three guys that we had working for us. Mm-hmm. And we were like, no. And so we gave back 75% of the money that That's we raised. Great. And we paid the guys out, you know, a month, 6 weeks or something into the future. And we, you know, we contacted everyone, you know, that we had been working with. And we were just like, we're shutting down for this reason. And this is just what we think it's going to, we think it's the right thing to do. And as a consequence, we were actually approached by, you know, FailCon, you know, and both Chris and I were like, look, I'm glad that we could give a good story of, you know, sort of a failed startup. And there is no shame, but we're not going to be the poster boys for failing.
Yeah. But I do remember seeing a presentation that Chris did at one of the local events.
Like everything. He does everything super well.
Yeah, it was great the way he framed it. And my favorite part was he said, we created a zip line. He's like, zip line sounds awesome. Everybody tries it once.
Yeah.
And it turns out to not be.
Yeah. As you want to do it again?
You don't want to do it again. No.
and also the way we would have been able to tell that in the beginning was we, instead of listening to what people say, you need to watch what they do. You know, everybody loved it. Nobody came back. You know, it's
Was that the biggest lesson you took from Other Screen, or was there something else?
Yeah. Okay. And it's you right from the beginning, you got to go to the numbers, you know, and you can't be clouded by people, you know, people that want your favor or whatever, either because they're your friends or, you know, for whatever reason, you know, they were telling us what we wanted to hear and we were listening to it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I had on the podcast a guy named Scott Lean, who you may have met. He was an investor and advisor in Reward Summit, and he is the best product guy I know. He's built a tablet that he calls the GrandPad, and he sells, his commercials are on cable TV. He's in Target and Best Buy now, and he's just the best product guy I've ever met. He learned a lot of it at Intuit, Bank of America, and at Best Buy. And one of the things he talked a lot about with us is get out there and just, even if you buy a $10 Starbucks card for people randomly on the street, see if they'll come let you video them using your product and trying it and and playing around with it. And he's real adamant about you can't rely on people that you know. Because they're gonna be nice, not gonna tell you your baby's ugly. You know it is ugly. You want someone who will show you.
Also, something that I learned at very, very early at Jigsaw as well. It was amazing. Jigsaw, you know, from a product point of view, you know, in any given time that you would log on to Jigsaw, I mean, sometimes it looked like Google, where it was just like a line, like you plug in what you want and we'll just give it to you, to look like a Korean social network. You know, I got shit flashing over here and just, you know, here's all the things that, you know, and it was like, I used the super thirsty horse to like the crystal oasis. And it's like, you have to drag that horse in there and cram it in there. And the number of people that would look at Jigsaw and they'd be like, what do I do now? And you're like, really?
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's like people, I mean, they're just the path of least resistance, you know, and I'm the worst. You know, I was the dummy tester for a lot of stuff at Jigsaw because I was like, I don't get it. Like, I don't want to think, I don't want to learn anything. I want just what I want, and I want it now, and it needs to just appear.
Yeah.
You know, so that thing about watching people unprompted, like what they do, is that's how it's going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So did your success, you mentioned this wasn't your first rodeo, but did your success at Jigsaw make failure at Other Screen easier or harder to swallow? Because I could see an argument for either one.
Well, ultimately made it a lot easier because I had money.
Yeah, and you had success.
So yeah, I mean, if it was like Jigsaw, if that had gone belly up, then I go bankrupt and you know, move back to Vermont or whatever, then I think you could argue that it was much easier than the reverse. But no, you're right. You know, it's and I was even saying with my mouth, I'm like, look, I can't think just because Jigsaw was ultimately successful,
no guarantee that,
that
it's
I know
again.
What's going on. You know, yeah. don't give in to what everyone's telling you. You know that yeah. It's like before you have a success, nobody will listen to you, and after you have a success, everybody thinks you know everything. And yeah. And neither one of those are true. And also, what is really driven into me is because I've had more failures than that since. I mean, Jigsaw was a truly it was close to an invention. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
Much more so than a lot of these things, and which are really just slightly better than what's out there. And you couldn't get this information anywhere else, and it was cheap, and it was mm-hmm. you know, it really was. And all the potholes that we had to fall into and all the things that had to get right and all the timing things that had to be perfect in order for us to have an exit, you know, it's just, it's not like, the first thing that I say to entrepreneurs is especially in technology, is I try to get them off their idea. You know, mm-hmm. like your idea is just a thing. You know, my favorite is like, well, you need to sign my NDA. And like, A, I'm not going to steal your fucking idea. B, like, I, it's all in the execution.
I have to show you. I wrote a solo. I do these also solo short form things, and I have one called Fuck Your Idea.
Yeah.
And I rant in it vehemently. I haven't recorded it yet. I've just written it. I rant in it vehemently about the guy that asked for you to sign an NDA. Like, right. No, I'm not. No.
No. You know, it's like, no. Like, yeah. because you need to understand that it's all about the doing.
Yeah.
You know, and like so many things happened.
Facebook wasn't an idea. MySpace and Friendster had already done it. It was just flawless execution. It was
right.
And it was luck timing. And timing.
It
and
was timing.
Yeah.
I mean, timing is
yep.
literally, if there's one thing that's been driven into me, I mean, I've worked for 10, 15 startups,
mm-hmm.
and most of them were just poorly timed. You know,
yeah.
and like, yeah, some of them had other problems as well that you point to, but timing is yeah. the market has to be ready
yeah.
for this thing, you know, and it doesn't, you could be the greatest tech team and, but it's all about the execution,
yeah.
you know, that, and the things going right and the perseverance and the making the right choice, either the right choice of not to pursue some leg or the choice to pursue some leg,
yeah.
you know, in a startup. Those things are infinitely more important. That's why when I'm evaluating these companies about, you know, say, will I invest or, you know, at Tech Breakfast or whatever, it's like, it's who it is, it's what the market is and the timing, and then there's the idea. I'm
yeah.
like, and the idea is way down here.
Yeah.
I'm like,
well,
really, it's who you are and is the market ready for this?
Yeah, well, and Greg... To your point, Greg Brown was on the podcast recently, and he said exactly that. And he said, the idea is going to change. You're all going to pivot. Nobody's smart enough to know what the real thing is necessarily.
Right.
Are they smart enough? And are they not tied to their idea so much? Because if you are tied to the idea, you're going to miss the pivot and you're going to miss what the real business might actually be.
Absolutely right.
So you mentioned investing. I believe you're pretty active in it. What would you... Not which specific company, but could you describe maybe the best investing experience you've had in Charlotte? What are the things that you saw, the behavior, the...
Well, I'm going to pop out with not what you're expecting, because I actually have been egregiously unsuccessful investing, and I'm not active for that reason. I'm not particularly active in investing in particularly technology mm-hmm. companies, because it's just... It's a crapshoot, you
yeah.
know, and it's a super crapshoot. And it's and at the advice of my financial advisor and my wife, I don't invest in these companies
okay.
anymore. And, you know, the most successful investment that I've had to date, meaning that I actually got my money returned and, you know, with an increase, is with a friend of mine, who first time real job and his partner in San Francisco in a restaurant. So that's not the strategy that I would suggest.
Sure.
You know, and but I do wave it over some of these technology companies. I'm like, yeah, I got a return from this.
From my restaurant.
What about your brilliant idea and your execution and your market and all these awesome things that you have?
cool. Well, yeah, I wasn't expecting that. I thought there might have been one or two out there that were good. But I agree, it's hard.
I've always invested in the companies that I've worked at. You know, and actually some advice that I have is particularly the company up in DC that I had invested in, which was very close in nature to Jigsaw. And I started out as an advisor, and then I invested, and then I ultimately went and worked there. And really, it was...
Was this the Scan Biz Cards?
Yeah, Scan Biz Cards, Circle Back. Mm-hmm. And my learning from that is you can't... Just because you were, you're steering a ship, just because you're up there,
doesn't mean
you can keep the Titanic from hitting the iceberg.
Yeah.
You know, and you really can't, you know, because it's like... The board and the executives just treat you as, you know, as a worker,
yeah.
You know, and I mistakenly thought that I could help to guide a company, and you really can't. Investing in, particularly in startups and technology, it's like investing in Columbus. You know, it's like you give him the money and he disappears, and there's only two choices. He comes back with riches, or he doesn't come back.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what's happening. You know, like your ability to reach out across the world, the unknown world, and affect any change, despite what VCs and everybody tells you, I think is nil.
Well, what do you think are some of the biggest mistakes that individual investors make with early stage companies?
I think that in their haste to have a me too, I think they put way too much stock in things that are successful, especially wildly successful,
mm-hmm.
on the thought that it's like, oh my God, Mike Zuckerberg has Facebook. Where's our Facebook?
Yeah.
You know, and I think billions of dollars go down the Me Too, you know, where there's
this is
like,
going to be the next Uber, or this is going to be the Uber of this industry.
Right. This is going to be the Uber. And I think
or the Amazon of this industry. No, Amazon's probably going to be the Amazon of that industry.
Right. And I think the due diligence that's not done on the person,
mm-hmm.
or the idea or the market or whatever, because they get their, you know, they want a Me Too, and they're mm-hmm. like, oh, the success of Facebook is proof that there should be another Facebook.
And not necessarily.
Right. And I think rarely.
Yep.
And I think that that's the biggest, you know, mistake that I see from venture investing is they just get blinded in their search for, for that next, you know, humongous thing.
So what's the biggest mistake founders make when they start taking on investors, do you think?
They view investment as the goal, you know, and you're like, that's, and it's funny because when we took money at Jigsaw, you know, we were like celebration.
Yeah.
And they were just like, all that is a bigger target painted on your back.
Yeah.
You know, and that shouldn't make you scared, but you know, it's just like, okay, it's like, what your really goal should be is like, okay, let's prove we're worth this post-money valuation.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not true yet.
How about let's make some profits?
Yeah, exactly.
That's
interesting. And I'd say the other one is going back to what we were talking about is being too wed to their idea.
Yeah.
You know, to the point where they put blinders on and they don't take market feedback.
Yeah.
And they don't make, and it disallows you from making good decisions.
I think one of the things I see people do is they make too concrete of commitments to things, and once you make a commitment to something, it makes it much harder, a commitment to doing something, it becomes very hard psychologically to pivot. And mm-hmm. so I feel like in investor communications, people need to be, number one, far less optimistic, focus more on the bad things and the challenges and the risks, and then especially they need to just be careful about committing, I think, to too strict of a course of action, because you just psychologically are boxing yourself into something that you don't have the options that you might otherwise.
I see what you're saying. I mean, it's I feel like the central struggle though, and it's so important, is knowing what the difference between persistent, because you have to be so persistent in your idea, you know, and if you think about all these amazing ideas that have come to fruition. It's in the face of all odds.
Yeah.
You know, against all, you know,
it's a tightrope act for sure.
And, you know, stuff like that. You know, it's like everybody's telling you that there's no experience that this is going to work. And you're like, you're like, yes, it is.
Yeah.
And the split between that and knowing when to cut bait, because you're going to poison your whole idea and everything's going to go down because you wouldn't let go of, you know, an assumption that was not correct.
Yeah.
I think, in between those two.
I think that's hard. The way I always try to balance that is I try to think about what is really the core essence or the core value that I have. And we built Level this way. We built it around our core values and core principles. And we said, okay, those are the things that never change. Mm-hmm. Now, and we do that so that everything else can change. And I think if the core values are structured in such a way that that's the part I'm never giving up on and I can structure it correctly, that makes it a lot easier to kind of look at things and say, okay, that isn't part of the core, that we can change.
Yep. I think that's great. And, you know, the enemy for startups is focus and or lack of focus. And sometimes it's like when you start to be successful, that's when these people come out. They're like, you know what you should really do is you should go off this way. And you're like, uh-uh. You're like, we gotta keep going straight. And I would say to, because Jim Fowler at Jigsaw was the ideas guy. I mean, mm-hmm. amazing ideas guy. But I heard from somewhere, I don't even remember where I heard it, but they were like, running a successful business is boring. Especially to the ideas guy, you know, because in the beginning he could think of an idea. We could come in, we had three developers, you know, and he'd be like, okay, put this in. Yep. And then he could see it work. But by the time we started to have success, it's like one of my roles was to distract him from the running of the everyday business, because he'd be like, oh, I met someone in a bar last night and they're going to come run marketing and we're going to go here. And you're like, we're not doing any of that. You know, it's like, we're going to keep doing the same boring business card stuff until we own it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. It's, and then on the flip side of that, when you, if you don't look for the new things, you end up in an innovator's dilemma where somebody's going to come eat your lunch. But but usually in an early stage company, that's the bigger concern is what you were talking about, not that. I think that what I just talked about, I think applies much more to a company that's a very mature company and got mm-hmm. a market that they completely own. And then you're Microsoft, you own the desktop, so you don't see mobile or internet or search or social coming.
Right. Well, yeah, that's on a much grander scale than my abilities are. You know?
Yeah. Admittedly, it's not. I don't think that most startups have to worry about that. But it is interesting to think about. So, what do you wish you guys had done differently at Jigsaw or at Other Screen? Are there things or do you not think that way looking back? You know, I wish I had done this a little differently.
In general, I don't ever look back. I think my wife will tell you, you know, like whenever she wants to, you know, she wants to gaze at a decision that we've made, I'm like, I won't even entertain it. I'm like, well, we didn't and it sailed. Yeah. So I refuse to think about it. But, and I would say from an Other Screen point of view, I have absolutely no regrets. I mean, I like given the information that we had and what we were doing there, it was, there was nothing to be done.
Yeah.
I don't have any regrets about how we treated people, how we did things. You know, I you know, it's fine. With Jigsaw, it's, I wish that I had been, it was my feeling that, you know, it was like APIs and like, you know, data distribution and everything. It was where the market was going. It was where everybody wanted to talk about. And I was constantly, you know, trying to talk about it. And it was very much, it was looked at, it was like, well, that's giving our data away, you know? And it was like, in our world, it was like, everybody comes to Jigsaw. And I wish I had pressed on that, because I think we would have gone to the next level. I mean, it would have been another zero.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always a tough challenge, because it was a very sizable exit, as I recall, and it's something that anybody would be very proud of. But you do have to be thinking, well, if it had been one more zero, it would have been a unicorn, right?
Yeah, and it's not really a regret that I sit around thinking about. You know, yeah. Ultimately, it was unbelievable. But you know, the other thing was would be, you know, in the very very beginning, you know, when we were splitting up the company, it's I would have paid closer attention, and I would have. Because it was our thought that I could earn my way into more of the company. And then as soon as we took investment, it's locked.
Yeah.
They were like, you know, you have a double-digit percentage in a company. You know, that's more than you could ever want. And it was like, you know, in retrospect, that's not, you know, it's you've got to, you can't get too caught up in it when it's an idea stage, but you have to really have it all guarded out and exactly like, should this thing get big, this is exactly what I'm going to get.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I think a lot of people don't even really understand the way that that works. We allowed key employees to invest in Level. We granted them sweat equity. And I never, there were very few people who I felt like they really understood what was going on.
They don't.
And even if they understand the pure mechanics, they don't, it's just hard to value these things, right? And
it's true.
There's so many variables.
It is. You know, it's, you're right. And I find that to be true over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, it just, it's difficult, especially when you're talking about, you know, a lot of employees or a large number of, a more than three, you know, level of people, then it becomes difficult.
My big challenge too was just people wanted to see the cap chart, employees, and
it's not motivating.
It's never ever motivating. It's and I was always having to explain dilution to people, because everybody would, when we'd go raise a little bit of money or a lot of money, people would complain about dilution, and I'm like, you don't think I know this? I'm being diluted just the same amount that you are.
Yeah. It's like diluted though, but it's like you always.
But the share price is going up. Yeah, yeah.
It's like, here's your pie.
Yeah.
Like, half of it is yours.
Yeah.
And they're like, this is a pie that's as big as this building.
Yeah.
You know, and you get way more pie.
That's what I tell everybody. Don't pay attention to what percentage you own. Pay attention to the share price. I don't care how much money I raise or we raise. If the share price went up, you are better off.
Right.
Period.
Yep. It is. It's hard.
Yeah.
And then it's, but it's not guaranteed.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people have a lot hard time with that.
Yep.
You know, they're just like, they want that number to be huge, but they're just like, oh, but they're not going to take it in place of, you know, guarantee. And they're like, well,
yeah,
you don't get to have it both ways.
No, there's a saying I heard that I use a lot, which is, he who gets paid last gets paid most. So, and who puts up with the most uncertainty. Because, you know, I'm sure 98% of what you made at Jigsaw was not in payroll. It was not guaranteed. It was on that one day.
Yeah,
or
it was on
the earnout
day. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And forever. Oh, well, I haven't worked at any job where I didn't have some equity in what I'm doing, because it feels like a waste.
Yeah, I agree. I couldn't agree more. So can you tell me a little bit about People? What does it do? That's where you're currently.
People is it's a search engine and ID resolution platform. It's 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was founded to be a Google or a Bing but only for people information.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if you put Apple into People, then it's going to be thinking about someone named Apple, or someone who works at Apple, but not Apple the thing.
Okay.
You know, it was founded in Israel, but it's a United States company. Up until about 5-6 years ago, it was a search engine. You know, it made its money by driving traffic or advertising. Primarily driving traffic to its partners, you know. So the use case would be, okay, somebody moved in across the street and I want to know who they are. So I put their name and a location into PIPL.com and a public search engine, and up pops sort of a sliver of information, a picture, and, you know, that comes from public sources. And then and then it would pop up like, do you want a background check on this person? Do you want to find a tax report on this person?
And then you get paid a fee on those, or is it a CPC?
And then we would
model?
Get a fee, you know, for sending the traffic to. But over the years, we became more and more, we were supplying the data. We got very, very good at data, not very good at, you know, the front end part. Mm-hmm. And so we found that we were supplying data to ostensibly competitors. So we became the data driver for them. We created an API, and so we could, you know, license the data to other search engines, and then out into the e-commerce fraud and, mm-hmm. and space, law enforcement, and then.
And did you get into some identity and verification as well? Is that mm-hmm. kind of where that naturally lands?
Yep. Okay. Yeah, that's where it leads, and then also because what we're extraordinarily good at is the raw data, you know, from public sources and all these access relationships we have. We're very good at not putting your Twitter address with a picture of me and somebody else's telephone number. You know, we're very good at being very, very sure about putting those attributes together.
Okay.
So I sell for them. You know, I don't have, very specifically, I don't have an executive position there. You know, it's like I do deals.
Okay.
And
how big is your sales team?
It's getting pretty big. People is about 110, 115 people. And I think we've got something like 20 salespeople.
Wow. Wow. And do you have different lines of business, or has the product just evolved over time?
Well, it's the majority of our revenue is via the API now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's we no longer have a advertising vehicle, and we don't get paid by traffic. As a matter of fact, we closed down the public search engine.
Oh, wow.
Because it was becoming sort of a liability. It's like the information, the value of the information that you could get just as Joe anybody, you know, by coming off the street, you know, and we also sell a copy of the search engine,
okay,
you know, into the fraud space, you know, and it's you put in very much like the search engine, you put in a name and address or whatever, and then up pops a profile, and then we are selling to fraud prevention and.
Oh, I bet the banks love it for anti-money laundering or know your customer applications.
They do, to the degree that they really want to discover that they they do, and they use it, a growing portion of our revenue is by selling those licenses, but it still is API.
What when you think about sales, what role does marketing automation play in the sales effort for you? I mean,
very important, you know. And it's you know, the closer you are to the top of the funnel, you know, that's where marketing and sales have to mm-hmm. be the most closely aligned. You know, it's like who we sell to and mm-hmm. and how are we going to get them into the funnel, you mm-hmm. know, those two have to work yep. closely to get together.
So are you guys putting campaigns together and feeding content to people or putting ads in front of them to drive that?
Just starting to.
Yeah.
People classically had no marketing because we were kind of BASF, you know, we were the search engine that powered other tools.
Gotcha.
For example, I'm in contact enrichment, but I don't sell contact enrichment to small, medium businesses or whatever. It's like I sell the data to companies that do contact enrichment and then do marketing automation and do CRM and do, you know, these, you know, provide lists and mm-hmm. do lead scoring and everything. We don't do anything. We're just very, very good at putting together the raw data, and then they, you know, okay. either resell it or incorporate it into their product.
Very cool. So how adjacent is your Jigsaw experience to people? I mean, obviously it's contacts, but it's
closely related. As a matter of fact, it's like my big challenge when I'm talking to folks is getting them to understand that this isn't Jigsaw 2.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, for example, we don't do contact discovery. So you can't come to us and say, give us all the contacts that look like this.
Okay.
You know, you need a starting point. You know, we can enrich, you know, you come to us with a mobile number and we'll put all the information around it and send and add volume and send it back to you. But we don't do because we're not like a relational database.
You know,
we've indexed the entire web. You know, it's like we input, I mean, we have information on 3.5 billion unique people out there.
Wow.
You know, that's signals that are coming from, you know, it's like we don't have some finite database of, sell to those companies, you know, that can do that.
So you're literally almost just vacuuming up all the digital exhaust and putting together.
Exactly, right.
Wow.
And adding, 14 years of bespoke relationships, like where we have customers that require, great example is, we work with the federal government, we work with government contractors, and they were like, could you get more coverage of mobile telephone numbers in the Gulf states? And so we went out and we found a way to license that information and add it to the index, you know, so it's, so in addition, it's that didn't necessarily come. It's still coming from technically public information, but not necessarily free and public.
Got it. Got it. So it sounds like they probably, I'm guessing that the owners of people probably knew about your jigsaw experience, and that's
yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I was partnered with people in the early days.
Okay.
You know, they would drive traffic. They would drive a significant amount of traffic to LinkedIn and Facebook as well.
Wow.
You know, in the early days.
Yeah.
Search engine. You know, it's
yeah.
When the time we shut down our search engine, it was still doing 1 million uniques a month.
Wow. So I want to shift gears. We talked about the vacation from two summers ago. Mm. Can you give a high level overview of the cities that you hit?
Yeah, sure. Originally my plan was to just take off and move to Spain for a year. And then we sort of did some research and we found out that lo and behold, our middle school kids actually do have their own lives and that would be extraordinarily disruptive. My wife reminded me, because I was thinking, I'm like, oh, we'll have a base in Spain and then we'll travel everywhere. And she was like, yeah, that's not how it's going to work though, because our kids are going to be going to school. And so they're like, if we want to travel, why don't we just travel? So that's what we did. And we traveled in the summer. So we did 9 countries in 9 weeks over the summer of 2017. So we started in Athens, and then we went out to the islands in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on a boat in Turkey, off the coast of Turkey for a week. That was probably the best part of the whole trip.
Okay.
It was pretty amazing. Then we went mainland.
And Turkey wasn't stable at the time, if I remember.
No, not at all. And we at no point did we feel safe. I mean, we feel not safe.
Yeah.
And we went to Cappadocia, but we did not go to Istanbul for that reason. Literally, there was a big protest that was going. Our guide left us to go be part of the protest.
And wow.
So we were like, oh, okay. But we really enjoyed that stop. Then we went to the Czech Republic, we went to Prague, drove all the way through the Czech Republic, through Austria, Salzburg, Slovenia, and then we were in Croatia. We did Zagreb and Split.
Okay. I hear that's beautiful.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. And every stop was amazing, to tell you the truth. And then we went...
Was there anywhere that was overrated?
No.
You probably did a good job of not picking tourist trap destinations, or maybe your wife did a good job.
We did some tourist trap. Yeah. I mean, we went from there to Paris, and then we went from there to Amsterdam, and then Denmark, Copenhagen, and then we ended in Norway. We went to Bergen and Oslo, and... I mean, Norway suffered a little bit, but I think that was mainly because it was the only place where it was cold.
Okay.
And it was the last week, you know, and I think we were starting to think about, the phones came out a bit more and we started to think about what was next.
Yeah.
But honestly, every spot was just, it was amazing. And we'd be like, whoa, we're so sad that we're leaving Greece, but we're going to Turkey on a boat, you know.
What do you think is the biggest mistake Americans make when traveling overseas?
they're too conservative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they listen to the media and they're just like, oh my God, we can't go anywhere in this giant swath because I saw something on Fox News. And you're like,
yeah,
you know, it's, I mean, I work for a company that was founded in Israel. Half of our employees and all the R&D and a lot of executives are in Israel. And they are completely, you know, even when things seem to be firing up, you know, they don't even give it a thought.
Yeah, they're safe.
And at no point did I feel unsafe in Tel Aviv. And that goes for Turkey. That mm-hmm. goes for all these, you know. I mean, that doesn't mean I would, you know, throw my family in a boat and go to Egypt or something. I mean, you got to be smart. But I think that's, and I would say the other one is you should revel in the differences in the place that you're going. You know, it's like these Americans that get off the boat and they're like, oh, where am I going to get coffee? Their ketchup tastes weird. And, you know, it's like, I just want to smash those people.
I want to eat what the locals eat. I don't want to eat what,
it's like you want to meet some new people. You want to do some, you know, if you're just trying to recreate your house, then go somewhere in the U.S., you know, where every city is the same. You know, hey, you can go to Target in the new city. You know,
like, yeah.
Congratulations.
It's funny. Chris Hart, my partner at Level, he travels well, and I remember him going to Singapore, and I had never heard about durian before.
Mm-hmm. Stinky fruit.
Yeah, and that was the first thing he sought out, and he went and ate it, and he told me about it. He made sure to eat it. I was like, "How'd it taste?" He's like, "Tasted like shit," but I had to try it. You know,
yeah. It's funny, but yeah, my experience with durian was. I was expecting it to taste horrible, and it actually tastes pretty good.
They say it's genetic, that like 75% of people think it tastes awful, and 25%...
It smells awful. 100% of people, I would 99 are going to tell you that it smells awful, because it smells awful.
Okay.
But it tasted like, to me, it tasted like maybe like a little bit like an overripe banana a little bit.
Okay. That's not bad.
It wasn't bad.
So... one of the questions, and we probably don't have enough time to fully distill it, but what to you is the key to happiness? Every time I see
on, we can distill that in like a minute.
But you're smiling and you're full of energy when I see you. So like, what is it? What are the high level things you think that have kept you so happy, even up, you know, through ups and downs and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I am absolutely convinced that the key to happiness is wanting what you have, and however you need to calibrate that.
Yeah.
And however, you know, your journey into, you know, being comfortable where you are and being happy with what you have is the degree that you're going to be happy. And there's no money. And I mean, obviously, anything I say is going to be cliched, but, you know, there's no event. There's no event or relationship or thing or person that's ever going to. And also, happy isn't like a finish line. You're like, woo, I'm happy from here on in. You know, it's just a state that you kind of go in and out of, and being okay with that.
I think you hit the nail on the head with, I mean, I think it's all true, but it's really about your expectations. I think it's we all have this story going on in our head, and we all have this story that we're hoping that others are perceiving. And then I think it's just how aligned are those? Am I truly the person that I'm portraying to the rest of the world? And I think if you're not, you can't be happy, right?
Right.
And if you can't...
Well, that's true. But you need to not listen to that voice in your head that says you're a pretender, or that you're not as good as what you're trying to portray, and, you know, whatever. It's like, you can't listen to that, you know, all the time. You just... And for
that's
me,
a very
it's
good
just
point.
Like, I just try to be honest and in tune and whatever, and try not to think too much about what other people think of you, but it's ingrained in all of us, you know. And it's part of, you know, if everybody I interacted with seemed to think I was a douchebag, that would not make me happy. You know, I mean, so it's
I don't think you're a douchebag.
No, awesome. And see, so I'm happy for right now.
Yeah, you hit that finish line. So you to me, at least in my mind, you are the classic definition of an extrovert. First of all, am I right? Yeah. Sometimes people appear to be extroverts and maybe aren't. But how important is it to you to have this trait in a founder, do you think, in order for a company to be successful? Is having somebody on the team that's an extrovert and really outgoing really important, or is it not as important?
Look, I think it's helpful, but I believe this you have to be who you are. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think the most important thing is that nobody's trying to be somebody that they're not.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, I mean, I've been in sales for a long time, and yes, it is helpful that I have this, you know, that I am an extrovert and that I do have this personality, but what's necessary to be successful in sales is persistence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's like, it's just like being smart. Like, I consider myself pretty smart, but it's not what's necessary. You know,
yeah.
There's all sorts of smart, extroverted people out there that aren't successful, you know, cause they're not focused or mm-hmm. they're not persistent or they're lazy or they're, you know, whatever. There's all sorts of different reasons. But, I think going back to your question, does there have to be the sales guy, you know, the face of the company? I think it's helpful,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think it's absolutely necessary.
I agree with that. One thing that's interesting to me is the flip side of that, benefits of introverts on founding teams. And I feel like you almost, there has to be somebody on the team or at the top tier that is a little bit more introverted. I don't know why. I've just come to appreciate that, I think, over the past five to 10 years.
Yeah. I think the ideal is what you would think.
Yeah.
Two people,
mm-hmm.
one who's more, and then you compliment. Yeah. But I mean, I founded Jigsaw with another sales guy,
yeah.
and a lot of people were just like, "You guys are the same." And but what we really found out is the elements of our personalities that were, because I was very surprised that Fowler, he liked to deal with the press, and he dealt with the investors and whatever in the VC community. He would not deal with the customers, and he didn't really deal with the members, you know,
okay.
the sales people. That was all me,
okay.
you know, and even though he was a sales guy, and even that it's just, and he was very interested in the product, you know, which I used to, in a derogatory way, I'm like, you're always fiddling with the buttons on the website. Who cares about the buttons on the website? You know, it's all about the people. Cause I was very heavily
yeah.
geared towards the
community,
you know,
and the,
yeah, yeah. The personal interactions. But that was the way that we were complimentary, you know, with an E.
Yep.
Yeah. There were definitely times where we were not very complimentary with an I.
It's going to happen.
Comes from being startup married.
Yeah. I agree. One last question I'd like to get before I let you out of here on a Friday night. I'd love to get your thoughts about the whole HQ discussion. A lot of people here seem to really think Charlotte had a shot. Full disclosure, I don't think I was in that group, although I do love our city. Why were they so surprised when we didn't make the first cut, what do you think?
Is it they don't know how the world works.
Yeah.
I mean,
or it's oversized charlatan pride, maybe? Or
yeah, I really don't know how to... Especially the way that it turned out, you know, mm-hmm. like where they ultimately went, like New York and DC, like, because yeah. that's where the guy at the top, you know, is,
yeah.
That's where his sights are set,
you
yeah. know, and obviously hindsight is 2020, but I think Charlotte is a wonderful place, but, you know, to think that, you know, to be flabbergasted the way some people were,
oh, they were.
Was, I mean, I think we should.
I mean,
you
could argue that's why the chamber and the regional partnership got merged together. Ultimately, there are a lot of it opened up a lot of
yeah.
division within the city.
Well, I think it's good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in a way, you know, because it's when people had a very rubber hits the road, you know, sort of thing with an outcome, you know, and it's just and you know, and I'd like to think that I helped a little bit, you know, some mm-hmm. of the people that were scrambling around trying to think of all the great things about
yeah.
about Charlotte. But it wasn't surprising to me, and I don't think it takes away anything from Charlotte whatsoever. I mean, I don't think we should have wounded pride, you know,
yeah.
that Amazon didn't choose us, because I think in reality, like so many large corporate things, it's getting decided not on by the things that are right in front of us.
Yeah.
You know, that it's our, I think it already been pre-decided, to tell you the truth. And
I thought DC very early on. There was a period when I thought maybe like in Atlanta, but it always seemed like DC. The internet starts there. The fastest internet connection in the world is there. They've already headquartered AWS there. Mm-hmm. Their largest shareholder owns the biggest home in DC. He owns the local newspaper. Tech is going to be gearing up for the next, I think, 5 to 10 to 15 years, fighting off the government, fighting off the EU, and you need to be in DC.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right on all those points. And I mean, just the exercise of making every city, you know, especially all these sort of second tier cities, yeah. you know, just literally just stand on their head and scratch their belly and whatever. Yeah. I mean, it's
think of all the data they got too in doing that. I mean,
But I think to the degree that it makes the city, you know, really come together mm-hmm. and have a lot of people that are, you know, I love Charlotte pride. You
yeah.
know, I mean, because I'm proud of the place.
I am too.
It's certainly not going to be lessened in any way. You know, the Amazon didn't choose us. It would have been cool if they did, but they didn't.
Yeah. I mean, to me, maybe the lesson should be what are the things, if we ever want to attract this kind of a company, mm-hmm. what are the things we should be doing? Because those are probably things we should be doing whether we're attracting companies or not. It's mm-hmm. they want to be in a world-class city. And if we want to be a world-class city, maybe there's something we can learn from that. So. Right. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Garth, on a Friday afternoon. Really appreciate it, and look forward to catching up with you the next time.
Perfect. Thanks for having me.
All right. Cheers.